It is Friday, December the 1st. This is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you with us. Coming up, the latest on North Korea following this week's missile test.
There is the possibility that North Korea could use the nuclear deterrent, once it has a nuclear deterrent, to try to engage in a more coercive escalatory policy to try to extort economic aid or concessions or security guarantees from the United States and South Korea.
The Pope is in Bangladesh. It is World AIDS Day. Also a look at the music world's Grammy Awards. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. The Trump administration, after calling for all countries to cut ties with North Korea following its latest ballistic missile test, stopped short Thursday of advocating a regime change in Pyongyang. However, earlier in the day, President Trump appeared to suggest it was time for Kim Jong-un, who is a third-generation leader of North Korea, to be replaced. In an editorial in the state-run China Daily, China has warned tensions over North Korea's nuclear and missile testing is getting out of hand. It suggested the U.S. is relisting of North Korea as a state sponsor of terrorism only served to accentuate the belief that President Trump's interest in diplomacy is simply for show and may have prompted Wednesday's latest missile test. It called on the stakeholders to put an end to Pyongyang's dangerous game by engaging in dialogue leading to a peace treaty. At the United Nations Security Council, Under Secretary General for Political Affairs is Jeffrey Feldman. He took part in a meeting on North Korea's test of apparently new intercontinental ballistic missile.
This is the DPRK's third test of a ballistic missile of apparent intercontinental range in less than 6 months. And its 20th ballistic missile launch this year. The DPRK, again, did not issue any airspace or maritime safety notifications. Mr. President, this is the 13th time the Council has met to discuss the DPRK in 2017. The DPRK's repeated nuclear and missile tests over the past 2 years have created great tension on the Korean Peninsula and beyond. This dynamic must be reversed. The solution can only be political. Given the grave risks associated with any military confrontation, in exercise of its primary responsibilities, the Security Council needs to do all it can to prevent an escalation. Unity in the Security Council is critical. Security Council unity also creates an opportunity for sustained diplomatic engagement, an opportunity that must be seized in these dangerous times to seek off-ramps and work to create conditions for negotiations.
The U.S. Ambassador to the U.N., Nikki Haley, said if war comes, it will be because of continued acts of aggression like the latest missile test. She also appealed to China to cut its oil supply to North Korea, a position rejected by Russia. The U.S. also said it is contemplating further sanctions, including interdicting goods heading to or coming from North Korea by boat. Robert Manning, a senior fellow in the international security area at the Atlantic Council, tells VOA's Victor Beatty it's too early to determine how effective this new rocket is for delivering a nuclear warhead on target.
So we don't know if their guidance system works. We don't know if their reentry vehicle can survive. We don't know if it can survive a horizontal flight of 8,000 or 9,000 miles. So it's not clear this is the breakthrough that some people are arguing exists. I think we're still a couple of years away.
North Korea claims that it's attained nuclear status. What does that mean?
Well, I don't know what they mean by that, because as far as I understand it, they probably had de facto nuclear status for some time in terms of having a device that could get a bang out of. So I think that they're slightly exaggerating their capabilities in terms of being able to hit the U.S. mainland.
Russia has picked up the mantra of China, calling for a dual freeze, a freeze on the North Korean program, and a freeze on joint U.S.-South Korean exercises. Would Washington and Seoul consider that?
I'm uncomfortable with that, the moral equality of it. In other words, North Korea is violating U.N. sanctions when they're testing weapons or missiles. And military exercises are the fundamental ingredient of an alliance. If we don't know how to fight with our allies, then we don't really have an alliance.
However, Manning said the U.S. has made a serious mistake in accelerating the timeline for exercises and stepping up shows of force like flyovers rather than laying back and trying to create a diplomatic opening. Ken Gause, director of the International Affairs Group of the Center for Naval Analyses, tells VOA the leadership of North Korea has two key objectives that would be undermined if it was trying to develop an offensive nuclear capability.
One objective is regime survival, and the second objective is perpetuation of the Kim family rule, both of which would be undermined if North Korea took aggressive action with a newfound nuclear strike capability. Because if they were ever to use that offensively, or even in a coercive manner, the regime could come to an end very swiftly. So I only see the program as being a deterrent and defensive capability in order to ensure regime survival. That said, there is the possibility that North Korea could use the nuclear deterrent, once it has a nuclear deterrent, to try to engage in a more coercive escalatory policy to try to extort economic aid or concessions or security guarantees from the United States and South Korea. But just as Pakistan found in the late 1990s, such a capability probably is not going to yield results. And so North Korea is going to be left with just a purely defensive system.
The U.S. has urged China for a total embargo of oil to North Korea.
China can't turn off the oil to North Korea. The pipes that flow into North Korea and bring oil to North Korea also bring oil to other parts of China. And the type of oil that flows through those pipes, as we found back in 2003, when you turn those pipes off, which they did in, I think, 2003 for some maintenance, it pretty much destroyed the pipe mechanism. So China can dial it back probably more than they have so far, but they can't completely turn off the oil to North Korea.
Ken Gause says it is past time to engage in dialogue. He said there are enough sanctions in place, and now is the time to see if North Korea's nuclear and missile programs can be frozen in place. He said a deal might be possible that includes no outside verification requirement and is coupled with economic and security incentives in exchange for North Korean promises not to test, proliferate, or engage in brinksmanship. In other news, U.S. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson's job again appears to be in jeopardy following fresh reports President Trump wants to replace him with the Central Intelligence Agency director in the next few weeks. VOA's Sarah Williams speaks with State Department correspondent Cindy Sane about all of this.
There have been reports over the last few months, really, that he has not been that happy in his job and that he's had some conflicts with President Trump.
Yes, that's right. And the New York Times is reporting that the White House Chief of Staff, John Kelly, has been promoting the plan to more or less, I suppose, force Tillerson to resign or trigger him to resign and to replace him with the CIA Chief Pompeo, who is thought to be much closer to Trump. And as you probably know, Sarah, Secretary of State Tillerson and President Trump have had differences on the Iran nuclear deal, on the crisis with Qatar, with Tillerson going on a major diplomatic shuttle to the region and then being undercut as he was flying back from the president. And the president seeming to be much closer to Saudi Arabia and taking Saudi Arabia's side, if you will, in that dispute. And also, right just at the moment, is on the nuclear threat from North Korea. We had Secretary Tillerson coming out just a little while ago with the German foreign minister, who is here, and saying, yes, we do want China to restrict its oil exports to North Korea, but not cut them off completely, which is a little bit different than what the president had said.
Any indication as who would replace Mr. Pompeo at CIA?
Well, the word there is that it would be Republican Senator Tom Cotton, who has been a leading figure pushing for a more hawkish position on Iran in particular. He was a staunch opponent to the Iran nuclear deal. So I think he would take a much harder line on issues such as Iran.
That is VOA State Department correspondent Cindy Sain. She was speaking with my colleague Sarah Williams. This is VOA.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Encounter. Join me and two advocates from the world of politics, public policy, or academia, debating critical and controversial issues of our day, bringing depth, perspective, and insight to the world around us. That's Encounter, every Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
Savor the flavor of African music. Hi, I'm Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Tune in, feast your ears, and dig in to an hour of amazing Pan-African music, featured interviews, and music news. Music Time in Africa, Saturday and Sunday at 1500 and 2000 UTC.
This is VOA's International Edition. Pope Francis has called for decisive measures to resolve the political crisis causing mostly Rohingya Muslim refugees from neighboring Myanmar to flee to Bangladesh. In a speech before Bangladesh's president, Francis instead did not call the Rohingyas by name but spoke of refugees from Rakhine State, that's inside of Myanmar. He also called on countries to give immediate material assistance to help Bangladesh deal with the crisis.
Nessuno di noi può mancare di essere consapevole della gravità della situazione.
The Pope said none of us can fail to be aware of the gravity of the situation, the immense toll, he says, of human suffering involved, and the precarious living conditions of so many of our brothers and sisters. He went on to say a majority of whom are women and children crowded into refugee camps. He says it's imperative that the international community take decisive measures to address the crisis. Bangladesh's president, Abdul Hamid, told the gathering the Pope's position has given the refugees hope. He also called on the international community to do more to help the refugees.
The very commendable position of Your Highness, Your Holiness has taken in favor of the distressed Rohingyas, and your passionate voice against such brutality raises hope for resolving the crisis. Your closeness to them, your call for helping them and to ensure their full rights provide moral responsibility to the international community to act with promptness and sincerity.
The exodus of hundreds of thousands of Rohingyas from Rakhine State into the southern tip of Bangladesh is sparked by a military crackdown in response to Rohingya militant attacks on an army base and police post that happened on August 25th. The UN and the United States have referred to the Myanmar military response as ethnic cleansing. Today is World AIDS Day, and the World Health Organization is promoting a campaign of universal health coverage to help the nearly 37 million people around the world who are living with HIV/AIDS. According to the United Nations Children's Agency, 18 children every hour are infected with HIV. That was last year, a sign of scant progress in protecting the world's young from the deadly AIDS-causing virus. It is a disease that can also have an impact on women. VOA's Lori London asked Lynn Erdman, CEO of the Association of Women's Health Obstetrics and Neonatal Nurses, starting with what World AIDS Day is all about.
World AIDS Day is designed to raise or heighten awareness about AIDS and HIV. I think we oftentimes get complacent, thinking it's been around for a while, and we forget that people are still being diagnosed with HIV. In fact, we've got close to 1.2 million Americans living with HIV today.
Of those, what about women? How many women are living with HIV, and do they give birth? And if so, does that automatically get passed on to the child?
The percentage of women is about 24% of that number. But out of that, yes, women that are pregnant either find out sometimes that they have HIV or they know it before they get pregnant. And it's extremely important to find out if you have HIV so that you can receive medication and treatment before, during, and after your pregnancy to make sure that you reduce the chances of passing HIV to your baby.
So would you say that a lot of the times the reasons that we see this in newborns is because the woman just didn't know that she was a carrier?
Absolutely, absolutely. The symptoms often are vague. And if the woman does not realize that her partner has HIV, and possibly the partner doesn't know, or the partner has not shared it with the woman, then indeed she could be a carrier. She could have the infection, but not realize that she does, and because she hasn't had, has not had very many symptoms. So it's good to be tested for HIV before you decide to get pregnant, even during your pregnancy and after your delivery, especially if you think you've been exposed. In other words, your partner may have used substances before that involve needles and so could have acquired an infection at that point in time, or could have had multiple sex partners as well. And so if your risk is higher, then you should be tested several times. Not only during your pregnancy, but before and after as well, to make sure. Because if you find it at any time during the pregnancy, you can start treatment.
Oh, so would that actually lower the risk of infection to the newborn?
Yes, dramatically lower the risk of infection. The treatments are really good now, and so the medications that the mother can take can help keep the virus at a low range so that transmission can't occur to the baby.
What can mothers do after the fact, after their child is born?
Well, if a mom has HIV and delivers a baby, then the mom will continue her treatment of the HIV to keep the infection and the virus as low risk as possible. In other words, kind of in a latency phase at that point. But the baby will also receive treatment for about 4 to 6 weeks. And that's extremely important to, again, reduce their risk of having the virus spread to them as well.
Where are we with fighting this epidemic worldwide?
Well, we have made inroads with medications, but medications are not available all over the world. And so we do a better job in the United States and more developed countries than many of the countries without particular resources available to them, such as the many of the new medications.
That is Lynn Erdman. She is CEO of the Association of Women's Health, Obstetrics, and Neonatal Nurses. She was speaking with my colleague, Lori London. It is time now for a report from VOA social media editor, Andrew Palchewski.
Social media isn't just for posting content. It's for removing it as well. Now, most of the time, it's for superficial reasons, like removing an embarrassing post that you made years ago or a photo where you don't look your best. But in the news today are two stories where removing social media has had a major impact, in one case positive, in the other negative. First, that positive story. Facebook is cracking down on terror content. Now, this is nothing new. For as long as extremists have used social media to communicate and recruit, social networks have been shutting down their pages and removing their posts. But Facebook is taking their efforts a bit further. Now, according to Facebook's head of global policy, Monica Bickert, and their head of counterterrorism policy, Brian Fishman, Facebook is now removing 99% of all content posted by Al-Qaeda, ISIS, and other terror groups. It's an astounding number. But what's even more amazing is that they're removing much of this content before anyone can even see it. Using artificial intelligence and machine learning, Facebook is able to find text, photos, and video that use terrorist imagery or language, and then before a human can even find and flag that content, it's automatically removed. In a majority of cases, that content is deleted from Facebook within an hour or less. Now, Bickert and Fishman say that Facebook's efforts have not only aided authorities fighting terror groups and recruitment, but in some cases, it's actually helped to disrupt terror attacks before they were carried out. So removing social media content can be used to do good, but it can also be used to do some things that are not so good. Like, for example, removing the Twitter account of the President of the United States. President Donald Trump is often making headlines for what he posts on his Twitter account, but about a month ago, the big headline was that he didn't have a Twitter account, at least for 11 minutes. That's because a rogue Twitter employee, on his last day before leaving his job, reportedly decided to remove the president's account. And even though it was only for 11 minutes, it had everybody talking, including the president himself. Well, a month later, someone else is talking. His name is Batyar Duisik, and he's the Twitter contractor who deleted Trump's account. In an interview with the website TechCrunch, Duisik, who is of Turkish heritage but was born and raised in Germany, said removing Trump's account wasn't premeditated, but was an opportunity that fell into his lap during his last shift on his last day working at Twitter. Here's what happened, according to Duisik. Someone reported Trump's account for a violation of Twitter's policies, which can result in an account being suspended. So Duisik began that process, and within hours, Trump's account was offline. While he tells TechCrunch that he didn't hack the account or do anything that wasn't authorized, Duisik also adds that in hindsight, his actions were a mistake.
That is VOA's Andrew Palchevsky. This is VOA.
This is BizBeat.
The Domino's Heatwave container is open. You can safely remove your order now.
I just got a call after my order, like, your order will be delivered by a driverless car. I'm like, oh, exciting. I want to see that.
You heard that right. Driverless pizza delivery, where Ann Arbor, Michigan is a testing ground between Ford Motors and Domino's Pizza. Dennis Maloney is the chief digital officer at Domino's Pizza.
Delivery is a really important part of who we are. And autonomous vehicles are a technology that's coming.
The vehicle arrives, customers walk out to the car, enter a four-digit code.
Input the last four digits of your phone number.
A compartment opens and the pizza is there.
You got it.
The experiment will answer questions about customers' interactions with the technology and also things like will they be willing to walk out to get their pizza instead of personal delivery. One thing for sure, if it all works, no more tipping. For VOA's BizBeat, I'm Philip Alexio.
This is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you with us. Well, the most prestigious awards for this past year's music, the Grammys, are set to be handed out early next year. We've learned who the nominees in the various categories are. And Top 20 Countdown host Ray McDonald tells VOA's Jim Stevenson this year's Grammy artists are revealing some new trends in the music industry.
Now tuned into the greatest. Turn the music up in the headphones.
It's going to be the 60th annual Grammy ceremony, and it really does seem to be emblematic of a new era. The Grammy Awards, of course, are when the music industry honors its own, and this is what sets them apart from other more commercially driven and fan-driven award ceremonies. This year's nominations were announced on Tuesday the 28th. Jay-Z leads the way with 8 nominations. He's already won 21 Grammys. Kendrick Lamar got 7. Bruno Mars has 6 nominations. While Childish Gambino, who's a fictional character, he's the creation of actor Donald Glover, scored 5 nominations. And the most nominated female artist is SZA. SZA, mm-hmm. Who also has 5 nominations. In the Best New Artist race, Alicia Cara goes up against Khalid, who also has 5 nominations, Lil Uzi Vert, Julia Michaels, and SZA. And for the first time since 1999, no white male artist or group was nominated for Album of the Year. And of course, that's one of the big Grammy categories. And so what do we have happening here? Well, this summer, Nielsen noted that rap and hip-hop, for the first time, have surpassed rock as the most consumed music in the United States, and that's largely because of streaming. So streaming is becoming recognized by the Grammy voters. Streaming hits dominate nominations in all of the big 3 categories. That's record, song, and album of the year. Most people get their music from streaming now, and the Grammys are reflecting this. Pop musicians suffered in this year's crop of nominations. Ed Sheeran only got 2 pop nominations. Many people expected Shape of You to compete for Record of the Year, but it's not. Katy Perry was shut out of the nominations. She had a new album out this year, Witness. And so were some big pop producers like Jack Antonoff, Max Martin, and Jeff Basker. These are previous Grammy winners. They make like many, many big hit singles. They're out of the loop. Taylor Swift is up for two secondary awards. Neither came from her Reputation album. Reputation dropped on November 10th. That's outside the Grammy eligibility period. So the makeup of the Recording Academy is changing. New members are coming aboard. Traditional views seem to be evolving along with the larger industry. It's going to be a very interesting Grammy ceremony, and it will take place on January 28th, 2018 in New York City. And even that is significant because it's the first time the Grammys are in the Big Apple since 2003.
Wow, a lot of changes, but a lot of reflection of what's happening in society as a whole.
Absolutely. You know, I think our popular culture and popular music is a very great reflection of the larger society. And we're definitely seeing things happening on the musical front with the Grammy nominations.
You can check out what's happening on the musical front each and every week with the Top 20 Countdown. Ray McDonald is your host. Catch him on VOA1. Also follow him on Twitter.
Yeah, I have a lot of Grammy-related material on my Twitter feed right now. I'm at Ray on the Hits.
Thanks so much, Ray.
You got it, Jim.
And one last item for you from the world of sports. Tiger Woods dazzled in his much-anticipated return from injury on Thursday at the Hero World Challenge Golf Tournament. That's going on in the Bahamas, where the former world number one is competing for the first time after a 10-month layoff during which he had spinal fusion surgery. He was pain-free, we understand, at the Bahamas, and he mixed five birdies with two bogeys for a 3-under par 69. Hat off to Tiger Woods. Many thanks, everyone, for joining us here on the Voice of America for International Edition. Always good to have you with us. For our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, Carl Starling, I'm Steve Norman in Washington. We hope you have a super Friday.
Next, an international public service announcement by the United States government.
In another sign of the United States' determination to help the nations of Africa combat terrorism, millions of dollars in rewards are being offered for information on several top leaders of the Al-Qaeda-linked Somalia-based terrorist organization Harakat Shabab al-Mujahideen, or Al-Shabaab. The group, listed as a foreign terrorist organization since 2008, is battling that nation's government for control of Somalia and has also carried out a string of attacks in Kenya. It is responsible for the deaths of thousands of Somali civilians, peace activists, international aid workers, journalists, and civilians, as well as African Union peacekeepers who are helping to restore stability and prosperity to the region. Tens of thousands of people have been forced to flee their homes amid the fighting. Under the terrorist designation, the United States imposed financial and other restrictions on the group, blocking property and prohibiting U.S. persons from engaging in transactions with its members. Now the U.S. is offering rewards for information leading to the location of five of its leaders. Rewards of up to $5 million each are offered for information on the location of Fuad Mohammed Khalaf, a dual Somali and Swedish national, also known as Fuad Sangale, and Bashir Mohammed Mahmoud, an Al-Shabaab military commander believed to have been born between 1979 and 1982. A reward of up to $3 million is offered for information on the location of Abdullah Yare, the head of media for Al-Shabaab. The U.S. guarantees that all credible reports will be investigated and the identity of all informants will be kept confidential. If appropriate, the U.S. is prepared to protect informants by relocating them. If you have information on any of these men, contact the Regional Security Office at the nearest U.S. Embassy and the tip line at www.rewardsforjustice.net or email information to info@rewardsforjustice.net. In North America, call 1-800-877-3927.
That was an international public service announcement by the United States government.